When did you start bringing everything downstairs, just so you don't have to go back upstairs again? Joint Relief Institute. Move better, live better without surgery. Call 708-888-0000.
It is an unbelievable treat for me to have my friend Tom Dreesen sitting here. You look very summery.
Well, I dressed just for you, Rick. This is just all for you.
As you always do. Yeah, as you always do. Tom and I spend most of our time outdoors at Gibson's, which is Tom's kind of home away from home. What are you doing in Chicago, Mr. Dreesen? You live in California. You are from Chicago, but in Chicago, I don't even want to say it's your second home, Tom. I want to say it is like your home.
Well, I was born and raised here in Harvey. Yeah, in Harvey. You know, Harvey. And then I started out in show business, coming downtown here, you know, pestering my agents, trying to get work and everything. So, you know, I moved to California 45 years ago.
Wow.
To do The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
In 1975, wherever you went in America, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah, you ever been on Johnny Carson?
Never.
So if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson, in the eyes of America, you weren't
sure.
a comedian.
Well, but
so,
even at that time, the notion of stand-up comedy, no one knew what that meant. I remember when Rick Uwat started Zanies.
Yeah.
And some of the calls he got, they'd say, now, what kind of comedy do you have? And he says, well, we have stand-up comedy. And people would say, well, you don't have any chairs there? You don't have any chairs? Seriously. The notion was, no one called Bob Hope a stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
He was a comedian.
Yeah.
And you, unbelievably, we'll talk all about Tom's growing up in Harvey, where there now is a Tom Dreesen Street, and there was a Lou Boudreaux Street, and you sat there on the sidewalk when you were a little kid, wondering if you could ever do that. But where Gibson's is, one of our favorite places in the world, mostly because of Steve Lombardo, who runs the place, that was Mr. Kelly's, a famous nightclub, ladies and gentlemen. That's when you and Tim Reed, as the comedy team, Tim and Tom, that's when you knew you made it.
In Chicago, when you got to Mr. Kelly's, you got to the big time. That was owned by Oscar and George Marienthal, who I caddied for at Ravislow Country Club when I was a little boy. And that was when you got to Mr. Kelly's. You know, we worked, Tim Reed and I were America's first black and white comedy team, as you know. History shows we were the last.
See, that's always an amazing thing to me. Why do you think that is, Tom? Why do you think there was never, I mean, first of all, people saw you guys, and you were successful, very successful in your time. Why did no other young comic say, hey, you know, I don't think Richard Pryor was looking for a white guy to perform with, but there had to be others who thought about it, yes?
Yeah, well, maybe so. America wasn't ready, really, for what Tim Reed and I were about, although I will say, you know, 95% of the people who saw us liked us, but we always had problems with that. When you think about that era, 1969, the Vietnam War was raging, students were protesting all over America, African Americans were rioting in every major city, feeling disenfranchised from the system. Harvey had one of the largest riots in the country.
Oh, yeah.
And here we were going across the land trying to make people laugh.
Yeah.
We did 11, anywhere there was racial tension, we went there. We did 11 prisons in 1 year. We did the county jail here in Chicago 3 times in 1 year. High schools, colleges, and America, you know, needed us.
No question.
Interesting enough, in those days, everybody said, you know, we need more discourse among the races. That was 50 years ago. They're still saying the same thing. We need more discourse among the races. Tim Reed and I were the only discourse among the races in those days. In order to have race relations, you have to have race relations.
Yes.
When you watch Tim and I on stage, we were having race relations. We weren't a white guy. We were a white guy and a black guy. We were having a lot of fun together. We were buddies, and we were making people laugh.
You also played. I mean, I remember you you guys played black clubs, and people looked at you. When you first got up on stage, people looked like you, you especially, like you were like from Mars, right? How would you calm down the crowd at
that
time?
Oh, we had such tricks that we would do, but we worked what they call affectionately the Chitlin Circuit, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs. You know, in Chicago, there was a Guys and Gals Lounge, the Burning Spear, the High Chaparral, the Dating Club Lounge, different place in Chicago. On the road, it was in Motown, was in Detroit in those days, so it was a 20 grand in Detroit. That's where all the Motown acts broke in before they went to Vegas.
Yeah.
And then it was a Sugar Shack in Boston and the Club Harlem in Atlantic City before gambling. But we'd walk out in front of, I tell you, we used to do it like at the Club Harlem. Interesting thing. most nightclubs, now there were no comedy clubs in those days.
Right, the nightclubs.
Yes, you had to work nightclubs. Most nightclubs, you opened on a Monday, closed on a Saturday night. At the Club Harlem, you opened on Saturday night, you closed on the following Friday. But opening night, first show was 10 o'clock at night, second show was 2 o'clock in the morning, and third show was 6 a.m. called the Breakfast Show.
Wow.
And people would come from miles around, all the waiters and waitresses, and I can say all the pimps and the hoes would come from Newark, Philadelphia, from Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, come to that show. 1,500 people, all black, 1,300 people. Now, there would be Mamalou Parks and her dancers who would open the show, and they'd get the show rocking. You know, they'd dancing. It was a heavy-set black woman with all these young dancers that would do the dances of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. You know, then there'd be a singing group, Sons of Robin Stone, then the Quiet Elegance Girl, and then comedy, and then maybe the Temptations or Smokey Robinson or the OJs or whatever. Now, we'd walk out. Tim would walk out. The guy would say, ladies and gentlemen, we got a comedy team here from Chicago. First time here. Please welcome the comedy team of Tim and Tom. And Tim would walk out by himself.
Yeah.
He'd say, we're really happy to be here. We just got in from Chicago. We've never been to Atlantic City. And pretty soon people say, we? I don't see we. Yeah. I see he, you know. Stage left, I'd come out real slow. A spotlight would hit me. And they'd see this white face. 1,300 black folks. And they go, what do we got here? What's going on? And I'd finally work my way to center stage. I'd be looking in the audience, and Tim would say, where you been? I said, I don't see any of my people out there. He'd say, no, I don't see any of your people. And I'd get real close. I'd say, well, we better be funny. He'd say, what do you mean, we, white man? And it would big laugh, and we'd have him from there. You know?
How did tell the story. I mean, I have known and admired Dom Dreesen for a very long time. And when you and Tim first decided to get together, it was because, it sounds so silly, Tom, because people were laughing at routines you would do as a speaker. It was not, hey, let's be a comedy team. You had no notion of that.
I wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children, eighth graders specifically, the ills of drug abuse with humor. I was in the JCs, right, a civic group. And Tim graduated from Norfolk State College. E.I. DuPont recruited him in Chicago as a marketing rep. And at the first JC meeting, he came up to me after I made this proposal that the JCs would sanction this as a JC project. And he said, I'd like to work with you on that project. And next thing you know, we rehearsed, walked into the classroom. And the moment we hit that classroom, the students reacted because the students were black and white, integrated schools.
Right.
And they saw us, and we made each other laugh. We poked fun at one another, jokes, played records, and we'd get the kids laughing. And then we'd plant the seeds of the ills of drug abuse. One day, a little eighth grade girl at St. John's School in Harvey, Illinois, a little eighth grade girl named Vicky Sarufka, eighth grader, walked by, looked at both of us and said, you guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team.
That was it.
The thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us. No one had ever done that before.
Yeah.
So we said, hey, you want to do that? And we start writing what we thought was material. And we went into a club and bombed one night.
Well, I bet. The early days must have been really something.
But then the next night we got laughs, and that was it. We were on our way. And Tim later became Venus Flytrap.
WKRP in Cincinnati, and then a director and all sorts of other stuff.
He was on a show called Sister Sister.
When you talk to him now, and I know you stayed friendly with him, he got sort of burned out on the comedy team when you guys were, and you guys were pretty big. I mean, you're playing Mr. Kelly's. It's as big as it gets.
Yeah.
Why did he decide to, he wanted to direct, he wanted to do other things?
He wanted to be more of an actor. You know? And a woman really kind of broke up the act. That's another story that was in the book, but he really didn't have the passion for stand-up comedy that you have to have if you want to survive a lot of years. You can't, because it's stand-up comedy is a load of rejections. By the way, that's what my book is, why it's called Still Standing.
This is the book. The book is, and Tom's going to be here all the way to 7 o'clock. I'll make him stay here. It's called Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. You can go to TomDreesen.com while you listen to the news and get a few commercials, and then Tom and I will be back here live, and we will talk to you about one of the things that has driven Tom, I think, is he grew up in terribly impoverished kind of circumstances, and it's been, I think, one of the driving forces. You will never meet a more sincere and giving fella than Tom Dreesen. We'll be back in a while. Welcome back. I tell you a million stories off air with my friend Tom Dreesen, a guy I admire tremendously. His new book is out, Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. One of the things that always improved, we were talking about his time with Tim and Tom, the first and still only, and I likely ever only, black and white comedy team in this country. And yeah, we could use one now, no question about it. What are you in town for, Tom? You're throwing out the baseball at the Wrigley Field.
September 12th, Sunday.
You're a huge Cubs fan.
Oh, yeah.
So fill up the stadium, ladies and gentlemen. You're tied. Will this tie you with Joe Mantegna?
Yeah, Joe's done it 17 years in a row, and now when I do it, I'll be tied with him. We're the two longest who have thrown and sung Take Me Out to the Ball Game, you know.
That's great. I love Joe, too, and I've known him for a long time. This guy, amazing. Two guys, a guy from Harvey and a guy from Cicero,
yeah,
are the leading ball tossers at Wrigley Field. One of the most interesting things about them, I wrote a magazine profile of him long ago, and it always intrigued me that when you and Sinatra first got together, and Sinatra wanted you to be his opening act. I mean, that's as flattering an entertainment offer as there could be in the world. But it was not when Frank was playing 300 dates a year. He was doing it periodically, and you gave up, and you told me about it, the chance for a bunch of different TV series, a bunch of other things. Was it your admiration of Frank that drove that?
Yeah, that, and I knew this was the end of an era.
Yeah.
There was two things I was doing at that time. One, I was playing golf on a Celebrity Players Tour called the Celebrity Players Tour. It was basketball, baseball, football, hockey, tennis, and show business people that were 10 handicap or below. So it was Johnny Bench, Mike Smith.
In your day, you were the best, weren't you?
As a comedian, I used to say I'm the leading money winner on the tour as a stand-up comedian. I was the only stand-up comedian on the tour, but it was Johnny Bench, Mike Smith, Marty Lemieux, John Elway, Dan Marino, Michael Jordan, 42 Hall of Famers in show business. Me, Matt Lauer, Brian Gumbo, Smokey Robinson, Frankie Avalon, Eddie Marinaro, anyhow, and Jack Wagner, who was the best of all. But anyhow, that, and I was touring with Frank in 45 to 50 cities a year, in 20,000 seat arenas, and flying in his private jet, staying in his home. Christopher Morley, the author, once said, "Success is living the life you want." And I was living the life. If you had ever told me growing up in Harvey, Illinois, that one day you were going to get inside of an arena and you were going to compete with the greatest athletes who ever lived in your lifetime, I'd say that's impossible. But I was doing that. And then when I was on my hands and knees shining shoes in bars in Harvey and Frank was on the jukebox, if you had ever said one day you're going to fly with him all over the world and appear on the stage and he's going to call you back out for another bow, come back out, Tommy, take another bow. There he is, Tom Dreesen. I would have said, that's impossible. But I was doing both of those. And that's why whenever the networks came to me for a sitcom, for me to give up that life, I said, nah, I knew it was the end of an era, and I wanted to be there.
What was it, Tom? You were a grandly talented joke teller. And I use that phrase with all respect. What was it about you that so appealed to Frank? I mean, Frank could have had anybody open for him.
Two things that he once, he always wanted a comedian. He wanted a younger comedian at that time because he was using older guys, but he wanted a younger comedian at that time, but he wanted someone who could change the material. And I had done 61 appearances on The Tonight Show, and you had to do a new 6 minutes every time you did The Tonight Show. And he knew I could, because we returned to the same cities. We came to Chicago every year.
Oh, sure.
In a different venue.
Sure.
But we're returning to the same cities, so he wanted someone who could change the material. And the other thing, a guy from the New York Times said to him one time, we were in a restaurant called Patsy's in New York, and a guy was walking by, and he stopped by the table to say hello. But he said to Frank, "Why do you keep Tom Dreesen with you?" And Frank said, "You mean besides the fact that he's funny?" And the guy said, "Yeah, besides the fact that he's funny." And Frank said, "Well, if I'm a saloon singer, and I am, then Tommy's a saloon comedian." He said, "By that I mean we're just a couple of neighborhood guys." And I'll never forget, I treasure that, because I grew up in saloons.
Oh, I know.
And so did Frank.
Sure.
Frank's mom and dad had a saloon. And when I was alone with him in the car at night, we're driving around, he was still in my mind the great Frank Sinatra. But when we were alone, he was a kid from Hoboken, and I was a kid from Harvey. And that's how we talked.
You told me once, and it cannot ever be repeated on the air, and I don't ever repeat it with friends in the public, about a time you were out with Frank, and it was very late one morning, and you guys pulled up to Bob Hope's limousine, where Bob Hope's face was kind of drawn on the side of the lemon. It's one of the great stories of all time. One thing that I've always, you don't drink. I don't know if you don't drink at all, or maybe you have a glass of wine every once in a while.
I don't drink anymore, but I used to drink. I used to drink beer.
But Frank Sinatra was a legendary drinker.
Yeah.
Most of Jack Daniels and
Jack and the Splash.
Yeah, and all night long.
All night.
Is being part of that inner circle, the fact that you didn't drink,
Well, I used to drink a beer occasionally, and he always said to me, have a real drink. What are you drinking that stuff for? You know, and then you know what I do sometimes, Rick? I'd get a Coke with a straw. It looked like it was lemon Coke, you know, because he wanted to stay up till dawn. The hardest I ever made him laugh, he never went to bed till the sun came up, whether we were on the road or off the road. But I think I told you this. One night, we had done one-nighters all around the country, and we ended up at Vegas at the Desert Inn to do a week there. And we did two shows opening night. Now, it's 4:30 in the morning. We're sitting around with six guys, and he's going strong, and I know this is going to be an all-nighter.
Yeah.
So I got up at like 4:30 in the morning. I get up. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to bed. He said, what for? I said, I got to get up early in the morning, go to the cemetery, and visit those guys. He said, what guys? I said, all those guys who died trying to stay up with you every night. You know? And he laughed. He said, go to bed. You know?
Frank didn't golf, did he? He golfed a little.
He did, but he finally quit because he wasn't good at it, and he didn't like to do anything that he wasn't good at.
Yeah, I'll bet. What did you, Tom, if you even know, what did you learn from him about the nature of stardom?
He like, I toured with Sammy Davis for 3 years, and that was like going show business 101. I'd sit in the wings every night and watch this brilliant.
No question.
One of the greatest stars.
Do you think Sammy Davis is absolutely underrated as an entertainer?
It breaks my heart that when they do him, they mimic him or something like that. Sammy Davis Jr., Frank would tell you, he never hit a clinker. He could sing as good as anybody out there. He could dance better than anybody out there. He could do comedy as good as any comedian. He could do impressions better than any comedian I knew. Yeah. He could play the piano, play the drums, play the trumpet. He was an amazing performer. But Frank, and they had that in common. When they hit that stage, they took command. They took total command of the stage. That's watching Frank every night. No matter how much he'd pace before the show, get a little bit nervous before the show, 20,000 people out there. Some nights, 40,000 in Hawaii. And that was a big responsibility. You know, 40,000 people paid to see you. But he would, once he hit that stage and that light hit him, 20 years would fall off of his face, and he took command. You know, and Sammy did that so well, too. Sammy, one night at Caesars, my very first time ever appearing in Las Vegas, I was opening for Sammy Davis Jr. in the afternoon.
That's amazing.
Yeah, my opening night, I was in the afternoon, I was walking the stage. He saw me. He came out. He said, are you a little nervous? I said, well, opening night, I've never worked Vegas before, and I'm opening for you. He said, see these boards on the stage, you know, on the stage, the boards.
Yeah.
He said, you earned every one of these boards. You deserve to be here. If they could do what you do, they'd be up here. They can't. That's why they're out there. You earned these boards. Don't let them take that from you.
Wow.
This is your. And that was how they when they walked out on stage, they took command.
Yeah. I remember when I had to write Sammy Davis Jr.'s obituary for the Chicago Tribune, and I wrote it. I argued with these people that it should be on the front page. I just argued desperately it should be on the front page. It wasn't. And they called me in the next day and said, Rick, you've got to do another one, because so many people had called that I did another story about Sammy Davis Jr. for the front page. I just think, you know, one of the things was he hugged Nixon. And I think that was like put off so many people. It was ridiculous. That guy was as talented as anybody in the history of entertainment.
No question. If you knew Sammy Davis Jr., he hugged stop signs. He hugged everybody. He hugged everybody he met. So, you know, by the way, he was the Jackie Robinson of show business.
Yeah.
Whenever I see young black comics mimic him or making fun of him, I pull him aside and say, do you know why you're here? Do you know the dues this man paid that you could be here? He was the Jackie Robinson of show business.
Well, and Frank was the Branch Rickey of show business because I
no
know
question.
That he helped get Sammy, you know, Sammy couldn't stay at Vegas hotels until Frank said, well, then I'm not staying.
Amen.
We got to take a little break, and then we'll have a few more minutes left with Tom Dreesen. The name of his book that you should, if you're just listening to these stories, there are these stories and dozens more. Very interesting and heart-wrenching, some of the stories of his youth. But now there's a Tom Dreesen Street. And his youth was also in a Harvey that is vastly different than Harvey now. Harvey's a little beaten up, but it could come back. The book is called Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. It's available anywhere.
Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
And you can go to tomdreesen.com and get it there. Stay tuned. We'll be back and talk for a few more minutes. Welcome back. I have a precious 10 minutes or so left with Tom Dreesen. Again, his book, his new book, is called Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. Another aspect of Tom's life, which I'm sure he talks about in the book, is the fact that he was a mentor, I think, because he was a few years older when he took off after Tim and Tom and got in a car and drove out to L.A. There was one or two comedy clubs, but there were all these young comics like Jay Leno and Robin Williams and Michael Keaton and David Letterman, who became your best friend.
Yeah, he still is a good friend. We tell us when I first went on stage, those were the people that were I was on stage with every night. All these unknowns, Gallagher,
Richard Lewis,
Dave Letterman called me a while back. You'll love the story. He called me a while back. He said, every time you get on an interview or I get on an interview, we tell the same story. How did you meet? He said, the story was that you came off stage, and I did, at the Comedy Store one night. It was his first night out in L.A. He had the old red pickup truck, and he said to me, I really enjoyed your show, Mr. Dreesen. And I said, oh, what is your name? He said, my name is Dave. I said, where are you from, Dave? He said, Indianapolis. And I started talking sports, and we became friends. Now, I said, yeah. He said, well, it's a boring story. I said, but it's what happened. He said, I don't care if it's boring. He said, from now on, you tell everybody that you came off stage, I had stole some material from you, and you beat the hell out of me in the parking lot. I said, now, why would I say that? He said, because it's a better story. Now, he calls me a couple weeks later. He said, do you know the governor of Illinois? And I said, no, I met him, but I don't know him. He said, well, my wife's friend has an autistic adult son, and they plant corn, beans, tomatoes, and when it comes to fruition, they give it to the homeless, and the state's going to take that property away. And I want to talk to my soul. I know John Cullerton, the Senate, Senate. I said, let me call. I called John Cullerton. John said, oh, don't tell Dave, don't worry about it. It's being taken care of. I said, John, would you talk to Dave and tell him that, because you explain it better? And he said, yes, sure, give him my number. I said, oh, wait, John, when you tell him you're helping him, tell him the reason you're helping him is because Dreesen beat the hell out of him in the parking lot at the Comedy Store. He said, okay, he's a good guy, John.
Yeah, right.
10 minutes go by, the phone rings. I said, hello, and it's Letterman. He said, didn't I tell you that's a better story? I told you that's a better story.
You're still friends with him. You have remained friends with everybody. Yeah. One of the things is, Tom, that you are legendarily one of the softest touches in showbiz. Someone wants something, someone needs a favor, someone needs you to perform at a benefit. He actually lives, he didn't have the street name changed, but he lives on Benefit Street in California.
I know, yeah.
What's the reason behind that? Is it part of it the way in which you grew up, or just part of, because it is, isn't it?
When I was a little boy, we had 8 brothers and sisters. We lived in a shack. There was no bathtub and no shower and no hot water.
And there were rats.
Rat-infested, roach-infested shack. We were raggedy poor. Every Christmas and every Thanksgiving, all the local groups, the Moose, the Kiwanis, the JCs, the Elks, they would bring baskets of fruit and ham and turkey and all that stuff to our doorstep. And my proud Irish mother would say, no, I'm sorry, my husband has a job, we don't deserve this. And us kids would be trying to get around the door to get that. But what it taught me was 2 things. Number one, my mother was right. He should have been taking care of us. And number 2, it wasn't the government bringing these things. It was people helping people.
Yeah.
If you leave Americans alone, they're the most generous people on the planet. And I always thought, if ever, and by the way, the first time I ever got a laugh on stage, I knew that moment, this is what I wanted to do. I'd been wandering aimlessly. The next morning, I couldn't sleep all night long. It was a Friday night. I went to Ascension Church in Harvey. I got on my knees and I prayed. I said, God, now I know what I want to do. I want to be a stand-up comedian. The thought that you can make a living making people laugh overwhelmed me. I prayed. I said, God, if you give me that opportunity, I didn't say be a star or anything like that. It's just make a living making people laugh. I promise you, I'll give back, I'll do charities. And God's kept his promise, and I keep mine. You know?
Wow. So you're throwing out the pitch on September 12th at Wrigley Field. You're singing the...
Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Take Me Out to the Ball Game. What else are you doing here?
What else am I doing?
You're seeing old friends.
Yeah, I'm going back. Harvey Days, I'm getting together with some people in a place called Tuscan Gardens. I should give them a plug, I guess. On September 11th, from 2 to 5, out in Glenwood, Illinois, all the Harvey people are going to come, and we're going to say hello and hang out. And then what else am I doing? I got a whole calendar of stuff I got to do.
Oh, I'm sure.
I have to do this week.
Well, now, Tom shares with me a weird thing. We both had COVID. And we both were hospitalized because of COVID. And Tom was gracious enough to let me write about him when I wrote about my COVID story. This COVID time, now, you know, 18 or so months, has been, you haven't performed anywhere? You haven't? Are you going stir crazy a little bit?
Yeah, I did. But then I, in Aurora at the Comedy Shrine last Saturday, I did my one-man show, The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh. It's a 90-minute show, and the crowd was so great.
Oh, I'll bet.
And so I've been, last night I went up at the Laugh Factory on Belmont and Broadway, and I got up there and I did 20 minutes. It's so great to be doing. You know, at first you think, can I do this?
Yeah.
You're a stand-up comedian for 50 years, and one day you don't do it for over a year. You wonder if you can do
it. Oh, I'll bet you do. I'll bet you do.
But it all, once they start laughing, it all comes back, you know.
Well, it comes back to that first time when you went to church and do that stuff.
Yeah.
Tom Dreesen, you're one of a kind, and Chicago absolutely loves you. There's a Tom Dreesen Street in Harvey, if you're in the neighborhood, and a Lou Boudreaux Street where Tom sat as a little boy thinking, wow, they're naming a street after somebody. And then they named one after him, and he deserves it.
And the guy who introduced me to the crowd was Lou Boudreaux.
I know.
That was a great moment for him.
I know. I'll bet. You've had a lot of great moments, Tom, but you've also given a lot of people a lot of great moments. The book is called Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. The website is TomDreesen.com. I'm not going to spell Dreesen for you. Thanks a bunch for listening. Krista, thank you for producing. Brett, thanks for doing whatever you do back there. Jack, thanks for producing this thing, too. I will not see you next weekend because I think the Bears are on or something. I don't know. I'm not going to be here, so there'll be 2 hours of dead air. But I'm glad I did this with Dreesen. Maybe Tom and I will go on the road with a white and half Irish comedy team. All of you take care and be well.